This is the SAE International Podcast Series. I'm Monica Noguera with the Aerospace Group. Today, talking with Dr. Michael Provo, a longtime veteran of the aerospace, energy, and asset management industries. Based in the UK, Dr. Provo has been a part of breakthrough projects and helped develop technologies impacting these industries on a daily basis. Mike, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, Monica.
So tell us a little bit more about yourself. You have had a long career, lots of interesting jobs, projects. Your education background is fascinating. Please tell us more.
Well, I spent three very happy years at Trinity College, Cambridge, in the UK from 1973 to 1976, studying engineering. In the first 2 years, I studied all aspects of engineering, like mechanical, civil, electrical, thermal, aerodynamics, etc. But in the third year, I specialised in thermodynamics, which set me up for a career at Rolls-Royce. I then joined Rolls-Royce Derby in the UK in 1976, where I worked for 27 years. My first substantive job was in the engine performance office, where I started in 1977. I worked on RB211-535 turbofan engine modelling and analysis, leading to iterative analysis, improvements to Kalman filtering, and the compass condition monitoring system. During that time, I gained a PhD at Cranfield University in 1994 for the original methods that I developed for compass.
So, Mike, how about your corporate career? It has had so many interesting aspects to it. Can you give us a little bit more information on that phase of your life?
Well, I decided I wanted a break from performance engineering, so I moved to corporate strategic planning, where they needed some engineering expertise to help with this very different field of endeavor. I worked on mergers and acquisitions, including the purchase of what is now Rolls-Royce North America in Indianapolis. And I also carried out many and varied projects with the CEO and the main board, many of which I'm still not allowed to talk about. After 7 years of doing presentations for the main board, I decided to return to engineering and joined Advanced Propulsion Systems Design, where I worked for 5 years, principally on the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, working on both the engine, which became the Trent 1000, and also more electric aircraft systems in partnership with Boeing system engineers and suppliers. I then moved to Data Systems and Solutions, again in Derby, which was a Rolls-Royce joint venture. Its Derby business unit was built on the Compass condition monitoring system, and I worked there for 2 years. I was asked to make engineering contributions to business developments outside aerospace, notably railways. Well, in 2005, I had a major change of career from aerospace to railways. I moved just down the road to Bombardier Transportation in Derby, where I spent 5 years leading the engineering development of the Orbiter railway condition monitoring system. My last employer was Intelligent Energy in Loughborough, just down the road in the UK, where I moved in 2010, developing asset management for fuel cells for 5 years.
Mike, this is a very varied career. It went from aerospace to corporate strategic planning, and then railways and energy. What are the aspects that you're most proud of, the things that you think really made a difference?
I'm really proud of the idea that I developed, which I christened iterative analysis, for adjusting mathematical models of aero engines to match observed test measurements. That turned out to save Rolls-Royce a lot of time and money in their engine development programs. I'm also particularly pleased with the algorithms, particularly the Kalman filter concentrator, and the data visualizations that I developed that underpin the in-service monitoring of both aero engines via the Rolls-Royce Compass system and trains via the Bombardier Orbiter system. I also was pleased with being able to make the transition from a pure engineer to a more rounded business person, thanks to my work at Rolls-Royce Corporate Strategic Planning, and I'm still great friends with my manager there after 25 years. I was particularly pleased with leading the efforts to persuade Boeing to make the 787 Dreamliner a more electric aircraft and getting the Rolls-Royce Trent 1000 selected for that aircraft. And finally, my book, Servitization and Physical Asset Management, which pulls together what I've learned over the last 40 years, seems a fitting end to a very varied and interesting time.
Yes. So, Mike, going back to this book that you recently published, as a matter of fact, with SAE, Servitization and Physical Asset Management. What is the book about and why did you write it?
I believe that manufacturing companies should sell what their products do, not what they are. This benefits everyone: manufacturers, owners, operators, investors, and end customers. After all, that's why you buy something. It's what it does for your life rather than just a physical object to sit and do nothing else except being looked at. I also believe that gathering data from assets in service, analysing it appropriately and visualising the results in compelling ways that aid decision-making ensures that those assets are functioning properly, extends their lives cost-effectively and makes good business sense. I was given the opportunity to write down what I'd learned about the above concepts over the last 30, 40 years towards the end of my tenure at Intelligent Energy. I wanted to document and share my experience to help others achieve the same career success that I've had. And I was inspired to write my own book by the work of others, notably the series of books on Integrated Vehicle Health Management, or IVHM, edited by Professor Ian Jennings and published by SAE International. The very positive response that I've always received when I present my ideas at conferences and seminars was also an indication that I had something worthwhile to write about.
Oh, absolutely. So, Mike, this is so interesting. It's so impressive what you have done over the years in this book, you know, as the apex of this putting together your experience. Tell us more about the concept of servitization. Not only it seems to be catching on across industries and different sectors, but it also seems that it enables these organizations to respond to market demands on a more focused basis.
Absolutely, Monica. Many businesses now realize that they need to sell solutions to customers' problems rather than just products. And this change of mindset is called servitization, or product service systems, or a new term that's just emerged, service infusion. It requires business to move from a make it and sell it mentality to one that considers what their customers' needs really are and how to help their customers operate and manage the products they buy from them over the long term, in order to achieve their own business objectives. As Rolls-Royce, MAN Trucks, Caterpillar, Xerox, BMW, Alstom, GE, and many others have discovered, the benefits from making this transition are genuinely transformative. Revenue increases of between 2 times and 4 times, and margin increases of between 3 times and 10 times have been reported, as has significant and sustainable business growth increases of between 5% and 10% a year. Companies see increased market share and enhanced customer satisfaction because they're selling customers what they really want, what a product does, rather than just what it is. Companies also gain more repeat business since customers like what they deliver and keep coming back for more and see more predictable income streams as revenues move from lumpiness to recession-beating annuities. Finally, companies improve their business reputation because they're seen to consistently deliver benefits to all stakeholders. Servitization increases business growth by up to 10% while reducing customers' costs by over 25%, according to interviews with over 30 key executives by the Aston University Business School. All businesses, from smallest to largest, can reap the benefits of servitization. And my book, Servitization and Physical Asset Management, is a structured source of guidance and reference information on servitization and physical asset management for all businesses at every level, from boardroom to shop floor.
So, Mike, the book is quite unique in the sense that not only provides a lot of insights on servitization and asset management, but it also offers an extensive literature review on the subject. Can you tell us more about this aspect? Literature review is something hard to do. It's a lot of work.
It is, but it's very worthwhile. Many business and academic commentators take a very narrow view of servitization. They see it as purely a big data, an IT problem, an analysis problem, or a field service issue, rather than a complete redefinition of a business. I realized that focusing on just one aspect of servitization was a recipe for failure. The subject has to be looked at holistically, as shown in one of the diagrams in Chapter 2 of the book. There are very many experts worldwide with deep knowledge and understanding of the broad range of issues that servitization involves. I wanted to gather as much of this expertise together in one place that I sensibly could and encourage readers to tap into this material themselves. Over the years, I've bought many books on the subjects covered in my book and downloaded many papers and presentations. I found that they naturally group themselves together into the subject matter of each of the chapters. All the references in the book contain material that is readily available for purchase and or download. I felt that it was important to give readers access to all of my sources.
It sounds like you have been interested in this subject for quite some time. Was there a specific reason or a set of reasons why? Tell us more about this experience. It's important to hear that.
My interest started in the Rolls-Royce Engine Performance Office when I developed iterative analysis and the concentrator and extension to the Kalman filter, which formed the basis of the Rolls-Royce Compass Condition Monitoring System, for which I won the Chairman's Award for Individual Technical Achievement in 2000. It continued to grow when I joined Data Systems and Solutions in 2003, helped along by the experience of business strategy that I gained in corporate strategic planning, when I could see the applications beyond aerospace that led to my moves to Bombardier Transportation in 2005 and to Intelligent Energy in 2010. My interest grew as I understood more about the importance of servitization and physical asset management and the wide applicability of these ideas across all industries, and was driven forward by the interest shown by others in my experiences.
Mike, with all this, what are the big lessons? A person who's reading your book, talking with you, listening to us right now, what are the big lessons?
I found 23 important lessons from all the work I've done that are applicable to novices and experts alike. The first one is that it's what an asset does, not what it is, that's important. The second one is that asset management is a business issue. It's not just another IT problem. Lesson three was that without senior management support, asset management goes nowhere. Another important lesson is know your assets. A deep understanding of your assets, the business context and ambient environments they operate in, their failure modes, the frequencies and consequences, and how they need to be looked after is much more important than knowledge of IT databases and analysis methods. Another one is that asset management needs to be incorporated at the start, not brought in later as an add-on gimmick. Companies shouldn't let the need for low first cost destroy the greater need to create lifetime value, because retrofitting sensors and remodeling organizations are very expensive and time-consuming processes.
So far, Mike, it looks like it is really a process, right? That you look at things right from the beginning and have a sense of their lifetime performance. And it doesn't seem to be something that is necessarily obvious at first because of, as you said, the initial cost can be very high. But yet, your next lessons seem to support the idea that everything that you have said before makes sense. Can you tell us more about the other lessons you have learned?
Yes, you have to break down the silos, open your and your company's mind, and look for what your customers really need to help them make money and serve their markets better. The benefits of asset management may not actually be where you first thought. Bringing all the measurements and analysis together into one single source of truth can produce many savings and unexpected value-creating synergies. You also have to share to gain with all the stakeholders. Partnerships between all interested parties create the win-win situations that ensure success. You mustn't underestimate the persuading you'll have to do at all levels in your organization, or the power of the heroes who feel threatened by the strange new ways of doing things. No one ever got fired, of course, by doing what worked yesterday. If the person who needs to act on asset management information isn't convinced by it, you've wasted everybody's time and money. Also, beware of people who just ask for data or confuse data with information. They need help to articulate what they really need by talking about identifiable measurements and focused information requirements, not data. This approach rapidly improves the chances of success. Asset management is a chain from sensor to business action. And if any link breaks, no matter how trivial, the whole process collapses.
So you talk about data a lot and the difference between data and information or actionable information. Tell us more. I see that from the lessons in your book, there is even more there to be shared with our listeners.
Yes, you shouldn't fall into the trap of putting the data cart before the business horse. Business needs drive analysis requirements, and those in turn drive data gathering in terms of both sensors and frequency of data gathering and transmittal. You can measure anything, you could measure everything, but you should only measure what creates value. You also have to keep things simple, because the smartest analysis or visualization in the world is useless if nobody else understands and trusts it enough to act on it. A physics-based asset model, which is where I started my experience, is a very powerful business and technical tool. It builds the foundations for full understanding of asset and business dynamics. If at all possible, you should compare all your asset measurements to a baseline, which ideally takes account of all known external drivers of the recorded values, such as load variation, ambient condition changes, and other quantified effects. There's always a baseline somewhere. It might be just a number in someone's head, or it could be a full physics-based asset model against which measurements can be compared. Find it, make it visible, so everybody can easily see what's good and what is bad. Residuals, which are the differences between measurements and baselines, are much easier to understand and analyze than raw measurements. A good measurement or analysis visualization tailored to the person you're talking to will make all the difference. Some visualizations, such as time series, XY plots, bar and column charts, dashboards, alerts, and drill down, will always be useful, while others, like mapping, statistical displays, reports, and system synoptics, may find more specialized niches in the organization or with customers. You have to use visualization to persuade and excite.
So when you talk about the analysis, the visualization, and the excitement, does that mean that this is all part of the convincing you have to do? Tell us more about how analysis can actually support the implementation of these ideas in terms of asset management.
One big lesson I did learn was that the appropriateness of the analysis is more important than the bigness of the data. Using smart analytics to back calculate what a good physics-based model of the assets could have told you gives a false sense of progress and potentially confuses failure signals with the noise of operational variation. Black box analytics also make it too easy to overfit data, which produces an analysis that is not valid for new data when it arrives. And it could find spurious patterns or correlations in large data sets that don't make logical sense, and nobody will believe them anyway. Cost isn't value, and you have to keep reminding the cost cutters of this. The $1 component that generates costs of $1 million when it goes wrong is worth monitoring. An asset measurement without a timestamp, unique asset identifier, or some measure of operating stress and environment is a random number from which useful information can only rarely be retrieved. Inadequate asset configuration knowledge and or asset configuration control makes meaningful asset management impossible. Some people just don't get it. You either have to re-educate them or remove them. If necessary, spin off asset management into a separate organization to allow it to develop and grow and free it from malign influences.
So, should you assume anything in this business?
Don't assume anything, because if you don't ask, you don't get. You have to know the limits of what you know and learn to appreciate the contributions everyone at all levels can make to the whole asset management process. Data is not information, information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not wisdom. Listen to everyone and anyone. Humility is a virtue. And finally, you have to push, but you have to be patient. Success breeds more success. Interest and enthusiasm will grow. The pace quickens, and recognition and rewards will flow eventually, sometimes from the most unexpected directions.
And you do have a website where you talk more about this, don't you?
Yes, it's called www.everythingworkswonderfully.com. On that website, you can find a short story, which is a 3-page account that I have written of the transition a company can and should make from commodity manufacturer to customer-centric servitized business. The story is fictional, but the events are based on my experience.
So, Mike, is this all about business, or can we actually apply these lessons learned to our own personal lives? And if that is the case, how would we do it?
I absolutely believe that we can apply these lessons to our personal lives. I use the ideas that I developed to monitor aero engines and trains to look after my own health, and I may have saved my life several times by doing so, most notably when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer early last year. I use these methods to guide and motivate an aggressive weight and fat loss program, which ensured that the surgery that I underwent was totally successful. I've also devised a method of monitoring urinary system health, which detected the regrowth after surgery of a urinary stricture before it became a critical issue, may have optimized the timing of my prostate surgery, and could be a benefit to all older men, 1 in 6 of whom will be affected by prostate problems at some stage in their lives. My health monitoring data helps me control my weight and blood pressure and are of real use to my doctors during my annual checkups, making them much more focused and productive. It also helps me usually stay on track. When I deliver presentations about servitization and physical asset management, I always refer to my own human health monitoring experiences. Everyone then sits up and takes notice because they can immediately relate to what I'm saying and they can see that I walk the talk. Usually at least one person comes up to me afterwards to inquire about getting a copy of my health monitoring spreadsheets. Our health is our most valuable asset. We should take as much care of it as we can, and monitoring ourselves like any other valuable physical asset is a responsible thing to do. And you don't need expensive technology to do so either. A pair of bathroom scales, a blood pressure monitor, and a pedometer is all I generally use.
Mike, this is super helpful. Thank you. And looking into the future, what are the big trends that you see already becoming best practices in this arena of health monitoring, asset servitization, physical asset management?
I think that there are 4 big trends that people should take notice of. The first one is focus on customer experience rather than just products. As described in the book, companies are rapidly realizing that customers don't just want products anymore, they want cradle-to-grave service as well, and want to build constructive rather than adversarial relationships with their suppliers. Equally, suppliers are realizing that the only way to avoid the commoditization of even high-technology products and the resulting race to the bottom on price is to offer superior customer service. This also makes it more difficult for low-cost overseas competitors to steal market share. I believe that these trends will continue as the pace of globalization quickens and competition intensifies. The second big trend is what's now become known as digital twins, mathematical and digital models of the physical assets that you are making and putting into service. These twins act in both a business and a technical sense. Now, we were using thermodynamic models of individual 535 development engines in the 1980s in order to help with analysis of engine tests. Indeed, those models formed the basis of the success of iterative analysis. Rolls-Royce went on to extend this concept right across the company, enabling them to make accurate business and technical forecasts and saving many millions of pounds in the process over the years. I believe that the widespread availability of high-fidelity business and technical modeling tools opens up these ideas to all businesses, as outlined in the book. As regards Internet of Things and big data, it's becoming ever cheaper, easier and quicker to gather large amounts of data from assets in service. The sensors become less costly and more accurate, and high bandwidth communications become more prevalent worldwide. These trends show no signs of slowing down, so we risk drowning in seas of data that opens up huge managerial and legal issues if not properly handled. Unless we focus on gathering only those data sets that answer the business and technical questions that companies need answers to. I believe that companies and their customers, having discovered that just having large amounts of data available isn't an automatic solution to their business and technical issues, will start to be cleverer about the data sets that they gather and how they use them. and the book gives guidance on how to intelligently gather and analyze data. Another new thing coming along is artificial intelligence. There seems to be a view that AI, in principle, just the statistical methods touched on in the book applied at large scale, will solve the issues surrounding large and continually expanding data sets cheaply and without expending too much effort. Nothing could be further from the truth. I believe that companies, after some initial embarrassing failures with spurious results obtained from using inappropriate methods that they don't understand, will need to build up experience in proper cause and effect business and technical models, analysis methods and visualization tools to make sense of the data that they're gathering. The book offers guidance on selecting and developing those.
And Mike, congratulations again on the book. It's an excellent piece of work that I'm sure many engineers and business managers will really profit from reading. Again, thank you so much for talking with us, and we will be talking some more in the future for sure. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Monica.
This is SAE International Podcast Series. I'm Monica Noguera with the Aerospace Group.